Good morning. I will call to order this remote meeting of the House Commerce Finance and Policy Committee and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Katisa-Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll present.
Representative Barr. Representative Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Dabney. Representative Elkins.
Dabney present.
Thank you. Representative Elkins. Representative Haley. Representative Cagle. Representative Lee. Representative Lilly. Representative Lislegarde.
Lislegarde present.
Representative Lucero.
Lucero present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice.
Tice present.
Representative Barr. Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Here.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly.
We do have a quorum. We do not need to be approving any minutes today, so we'll go right to our work for the day, which is to have an informational hearing on special session House File 6, which is the bill that would fund the Department of Commerce, the Commerce, Climate, and Energy Omnibus Bill. We will proceed as we usually do. We'll have a brief presentation on the contents of the bill, in this case by nonpartisan staff, the great Solveig Beckel and Lori Pompu, will review the bill for us. We will then take public testimony and then have member comments and questions. We will not be taking formal action on the bill today. The bill was not referred to our committee. It was referred to Ways and Means and actually received a hearing in Ways and Means yesterday and advanced to the general register. So this is an informational hearing. This bill, I'm really proud to tell you, I think is a good bill that we can all be very proud of. It's a good compromise bill with the Senate. It contains a great number of provisions that were heard in this committee, supported by bipartisan members of this committee, and that will do good work for the people of Minnesota, particularly in the areas of consumer protection and, of course, climate. So I'm very proud to bring the bill before the committee, and will be happy to answer questions that committee members might have about provisions that were in the bill or not in the bill. But to set the baseline for that, I think I will turn it over first to Ms. Beckel to describe the spreadsheet and then Ms. Pompu to describe the bill text. Ms. Beckel.
Mr. Chair, I will share my screen now to go over the spreadsheet. Okay, so this is the Commerce and Energy Finance spreadsheet. So it's House File 6 for the first special session of 2021. Just briefly, the light red here shows the base. The light purple shows the governor's position, blue, the House position, and green, the Senate position. And then we've got the final agreement or House File 6 in orange here. At the top, I have a summary of all the general fund spending, and I'll go into further detail as we get down. And then I also show the various revenue items and assessment authority savings at the top here as well, so that by the time we get to the bottom of this first page, you can see that the target was $16.838 million above the target, above base for fiscal year 21 through 23, and $8.566 million above base for fiscal years 24 and 25. So the first item that went into the final agreement for revenue was the debt buyer regulation change. just some minor increases that result in an additional $38,000 in savings per year for a total of $76,000 in savings or in revenue in each biennium. On line 19, we have the revenue that would be generated by the Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights policy that Ms. Pompeu will go into further, and that would generate $130,000 in the first year and $112,000 in the second year for a total of $242,000 in the first biennium, and then $112,000 each year in the tails for a total of $224,000 revenue in the tails. Then on line 20, I show the transfer from the special revenue fund into the general fund here. This is just showing general fund revenue. So this is basically, there was a small account that had additional revenue for the purpose of financial education. And so $300,000 was transferred from that account into the general fund. So there we're showing the $300,000 revenue in the first year. And finally, the administrative holdback for the Department of Commerce was $1.22 million. And you can see that in fiscal year 2021. In terms of assessment authority, the Public Utilities Commission and the Commerce Energy Resources Division are allowed to assess for the costs that are associated with their operations. So the Natural Gas Innovation Act, you can see for Commerce here, and then the Public Utilities Commission on lines 24 and 25 would both generate $189,000 and $112,000 respectively for a total of $378,000 in assessment authority savings and $224,000 in assessment authority savings for the Commerce and PUC respectively. Moving down, line 36, the PUC received an operating increase and so did the Commerce Energy Resources Division. So those are shown here, for a total of $689,000 for the PUC and $244,000 over the biennium for Commerce. And then there is an additional energy regulation and planning increase that they're allowed to assess for in Commerce for a total of $57,000 over the biennium. And the telecommunications increase assessment, the Department of Commerce may also assess for operating for the telecommunications division. And so that comes in at $69,000 in the first year. All right, getting into some of the detail, this will go through Article 1 for the most part, where the majority of the appropriations are. Article 2 contains appropriations for the renewable development account. So we'll get to that after this one. This is general fund and then other funds. So the changes in this include the securities unit relocation. This is just the department letting the legislature know that the securities unit was relocated from a different division. We'll see a negative amount in the change columns later on. And then the securities unit received an operating adjustment of $56,000 for the biennium. And they received funds for additional staff to the tune of $520,000 over the biennium. Then on line 61, the student loan borrower bill of rights provision comes in with costs of $508,000 over the biennium. Moving down, the Administrative Services Division of the Department of Commerce received an operating increase of $516,000 over the biennium, and then received operating increases for unclaimed property compliance of $25,000 over the biennium, and an increase to the unclaimed property IT system of $6,000 for the biennium. Moving down to the Telecommunications Division, The telecommunications division received an operating increase on line 81 of 69,000 over the biennium. And on line 82, there is an appropriation for the LCC for captioning legislative coverage. In relation to COVID-19, there were additional costs. And so they requested an additional amount of funds to cover this. So from the general fund, $310,000 in fiscal year 2022 only. In the direct appropriations area from the Telecommunications Access Minnesota Fund, which is in the special revenue fund, they received base funding for all but the LCC. Again, the LCC captioning legislative coverage, this received base in the first year, and then it received an increase of $33,000 each year thereafter, for an increase of $33,000 in the first biennium and $66,000 in the tails. Moving on to the Enforcement and Market Assurance Division of Commerce. They also received some operating increases seen here. So on line 97, they received a general operating increase of $358,000 over the first biennium, and then an increase of $446,000 in the tails. On line 98, healthcare enforcement received an operating increase of $11,000 in the first biennium and $14,000 in the tails. And then here is that securities unit relocation I mentioned beforehand. They simply moved that to a different division, and so there's that negative funding. Line 100 shows the catalytic converter theft prevention provision in the bill. Again, Ms. Pompu will go through that in further detail. And that receives an appropriation of $200,000 in fiscal year 2022 only. Then the Workers' Compensation Fund receives base funding. The direct appropriation from the Auto Theft Prevention Account, this is an account in the Special Revenue Fund for auto theft prevention, as one might guess from the name. So on line 106, you can see another appropriation for the catalytic converter theft prevention provisions in the bill. And so that is also $200,000 in the first year only. And then moving down to line 109, you can see the transfer that I mentioned earlier. Here's the special revenue fund transfer out. So earlier I showed you the transfer into the general fund. This is the transfer out from that consumer education account in the special revenue fund. Next is the insurance division of the Department of Commerce. They also received some operating increases. So on line 117 here, they received operating increases to the tune of $295,000 in the first biennium and $362,000 in the second biennium. They received core additional funding of $200,000 per year for a total of $400,000 over the biennium, and that's the same in the tails. The health insurance rate review received increases of $43,000 in the first biennium and $58,000 in the second biennium. Excuse me. The actuarial reserve review received increases of $28,000 in the first biennium and $38,000 in the tails. And then they received an additional insurance funding amount of $504,000 each year in the first biennium only, for a total of $1.008 million in the first biennium only, so not in the tails. Then the licensed registered pharmacy benefit manager provision received an increase of $10,000 in the first biennium and $14,000 in the tails. Then line 126, the mandated health benefit proposals evaluation, this is from the Senate, received $105,000 per year for a total of $210,000 in the first and second bienniums, let's see, moving down, we come to the Weights and Measures Division on line 137. If you look at line 139, you can see that they received funding of $1.5 million per year for a total of $3 million in each biennium. And so this is for equipment and planning. All right, moving down to the Energy Resources Division. This effectively follows the course of the bill. So I'm going to be showing you general fund, special revenue fund, petro fund items, but then the renewable development account will be later. Okay, so the Department of Commerce Energy Resources Division on line 147 receives an operating increase of $244,000 over the biennium and $298,000 in the tails. Line 149, the Energy Regulation and Planning Office receives $57,000 of increase in the tails, or in the current biennium, excuse me, and $76,000 in the tails. Then on line 153, we see the solar on schools provision that was funded to the tune of $8 million in the first year from the general fund. Solar on community colleges or other colleges and universities was funded to the tune of $1.242 million in the first year only. And then the Natural Gas Innovation Act, you saw some revenue from that earlier in the spreadsheet. That is funded at $189,000 each year. But again, that nets to zero with the revenue that I mentioned before. There are some expenditures from the Special Revenue Fund. On line 165, you can see the Utility Grid Reliability Assessment Extension. And so that was extended for one biennium. So that's $500,000 each year in the first biennium only for a total of $1 million. Line 166 is the Minnesota Efficient Technology Accelerator, or META, and that is funded, or there are expenditures from the Special Revenue Fund of $3.44 million in the first and second years for a total of $6.88 million in the first biennium, and then $6.02 million in the tails for a total of $12.04 million in the tails. Then I show assessment authority for the Special Revenue Fund. As you may notice, this is simply equal to what I mentioned beforehand. So the Utility Grid Reliability Assessment, they're allowed to assess for the Special Revenue Fund expenditure. And again, for META, they're allowed to assess for the META item above there. Line 176, it does show a change. This is simply because the Petroleum Tanker Lease Compensation Fund was set to sunset before the bill. The bill does not sunset it, and therefore you see that they will continue to collect revenues in fiscal years 2022, 2023, and 2024, where otherwise they would not have. And then on line 179, you can see the appropriation for the landfill bond prepayment solar pilot project. And so that receives $100,000 in fiscal year 2022 only. Article 9, excuse me, is separate from Article 1. It was added slightly later. So line 183 and 184 show costs related to the insurance fraud specialist salary increases or salary supplements. And so the salary increases are increased by $214,000 in fiscal year 21 and $566,000 in fiscal years 22 and 23. And that continues into the tails for an increase of $566,000 over the tails. The salary supplements, this is just for fiscal year 21. That's an increase of $58,000, and this is from the general fund. Moving down to some of the other agencies, for MMB, MMB receives $49,000 per year for the Minnesota the mandated benefit health plan evaluation, another Senate proposal. And so line 189, you can see that yearly $49,000 expenditure. The Department of Health likewise receives an appropriation for this provision on line 197 of $37,000 each year for a total of $74,000 each biennium. Then we come down to the Public Utilities Commission. This receives an operating increase of $689,000 over the first biennium and $818,000 over the tails. And line 203 shows the Natural Gas Innovation Act costs. Again, these are ones I mentioned before, so those are assessed and come to a net zero cost, but the appropriation is $112,000 each year for a total of $224,000 over each biennium. Moving down to the Department of Employment and Economic Development, they receive an appropriation for the Community Planning Energy Transition Office. So this is this receives $170,000 in the first year and $350,000 in the second year for a total of $520,000 in the first biennium. And then the $350,000 is ongoing for a total of $700,000 in the tails. The Department of Education, again, I mentioned this earlier, this just shows the appropriation from the general fund to the Minnesota Council of Economic Education from the Department of Education. So the funds, if you were watching, go transfer from the special revenue fund to the general fund, then general fund appropriation to the Department of Education for MCEE. The Department of Administration was in the bill and originally in the House side, but that came out. Same with the Attorney General's office and same with the Department of Labor and Industry. Here I just show a brief fund overview for the Petroleum Tank Release Compensation Fund. Earlier I showed that the fund had been extended. So you can see in fiscal year 2023, that all these funds are there. Originally, this had cut off after fiscal year 2022. So we see a change of 1 year's worth of the fund in fiscal year 22-23. And then we see the full change of both years in the tails. Okay, so moving on to Article 2. The renewable development account. I have a brief summary at the top here, and then I will go over the appropriations. So the Department of Employment and Economic Development received two appropriations from the renewable development account in this bill. There was an existing $1 million planned expenditure from 2020 session, Chapter 118, and so you see that here, where you may not see that in the bill. On line 283, we see the North Minneapolis Clean Energy Training Center that receives $2.5 million in the first year, and the Mountain Iron Solar Plant expansion receives $5.5 million in fiscal year 2022 only as well. The Commerce Department receives the bulk of the RDA appropriations. So they have appropriations from the RDA built into the base. So they received those built into the base. Also, we see that carryover that you wouldn't see in the bill on line 292. That's the Prairie Island provisions from 2020 session, chapter 118. And so those have appropriations that were in a previous bill. I'm showing in the spreadsheet for overall impact, but will not be in this bill. Line 297, the agricultural weather study receives $583,000 in the first year only. Line 298, the St. Thomas microgrid project receives $2.4 million in the first year, $1.2 million in the second year, $1 million in fiscal year 2024, and 400,000 in fiscal year 2025. This also has a little asterisk here. That's to show that there is also planned spending of 400,000 in fiscal year 2026 from the renewable development account for this project. Line 299, the appropriation for solar on colleges and universities, and that's 1.242 million in the first year and 1.138 million in the second biennium in fiscal year 2024. And so this matches the amount that was put toward it from the general fund. Then we see a number of provisions that did not make it into the final bill. Before we get to line 324, the solar awards extension. Now this is not in the current biennium, this is in the tails. So solar awards is planned to be extended through 2024 and 2025. And then on line 325, we see the RDA appropriation for solar on schools, and that is also 8 million in the first year only, matching the amount spent out of the general fund. The University of Minnesota receives an appropriation from the renewable development account on line 334. This is for ammonia research, and that comes in at 10 million in the first year only. The Department of Administration receives funds for a state building energy conservation revolving loan fund. That's 5 million in the first year only. And line 342, we see the State Building Revolving Loan Fund Administration. So that is 219,000 in the first year, 88 in the second, for a total of 307 over the first biennium. And then appropriations of 90,000 and 92,000 in 24 and 25, respectively, for a total of 182,000 in the tails. Line 343, we see the construction materials and environmental impact study, and that is funded at 125,000 in the first year only. And then these items did not make it into the final bill. So that is the entire spreadsheet, and I am ready to stand for questions. Thank you.
Okay, well, we will do questions. I don't see anyone asking questions now, and we'll you stick with our usual practice and do questions after we've heard from everybody. Next, we have a House Research, Ms. Pompu.
Hi, Chair and members. So skipping the first two articles, because those are the appropriations, if you start on page 14, there is the Credit for Reinsurance NAIC Model Act. And this goes all the way through page 25. And this is about insurers ceding risk to foreign insurance companies and how the Department of Commerce will determine whether that's appropriate. And then on page 25 and until page 40 is the Cybersecurity Act, which is another NAIC model act. It deals with the insurer's duty to have a plan to handle a cybersecurity event, a breach of information, and how to notify the Department of Commerce and its customers. On to page 40, section 14, there's a provision that changes the minimum interest rate related to annuities from 1% to 0.15%. On page 41, section 15, this section modifies the state Medicare anti-kickback statute, Medicaid. And it allows drug manufacturers to provide people with discounts or free supplies related to drugs that must be injected. That was kind of a blind spot in this law before. Section 16 on page 43 prohibits health insurers from placing lifetime or annual limits on screenings and testing for opioids. Section 17 makes technical changes that were part of the agency's bill. Section 18 relates to workers' compensation insurance and requires data service organizations to include information relating to its methodologies and the report that it submits to the commissioner. On page 45, section 19, it changes who must get a surety bond for the sale of gold bullion. On page 46, section 20, this section requires gold bullion dealers to notify the commissioner if a dealer representative of theirs is terminated because the dealer representative violated a provision of Chapter 80G. And then on page 46, sections 22 to 24 make technical changes that were part of the agency's bill. On to page 50, sections 25 and 26 change the maximum transactional value a licensed real estate property appraiser can appraise a property at. Section 27 prohibits medical assistants and Minnesota Care from placing a lifetime or annual limit on screenings and testing for opioids. Section 28 allows for expedited rulemaking by the Department of Commerce related to data service organizations that are providing services for workers' compensation insurance. Section 29 is a repealer. Beginning on page 51 is Article 4, that's mandated health benefit proposals and their evaluation. So Section 1 and 2 provide definitions and clarify what is considered a mandated health benefit proposal. Section 3 on page 52 describes what must be provided to the commissioner in order to evaluate a health benefit proposal, including at least one controlled trial and the effect on premium. Section 4 on page 53 requires a legislator who plans on introducing a bill or amendment that contains a mandated health benefit proposal to notify the chair of the committee with jurisdiction over the mandate. The chair then has to notify the commissioner. Section 5 on page 54 clarifies funding for the evaluations, and Section 6 requires a report to the author of the bill or amendment and the chairs and ranking minority members of the committees with jurisdiction over the mandate. Beginning on page 54, we have Article 5, collection agencies and debt buyers. This was a policy proposal from the governor's office. It regulates debt buyers in the same manner that collection agencies are currently regulated. They will be licensed and overseen by the Department of Commerce. On to page 64, there is Article 6, Consumer Protection. This includes the Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights, which regulates student loan servicers. It creates a licensing system and is overseen by the Department of Commerce. And then beginning on page 74 until page 85, we are adding a definition of volunteer driver to the auto insurance statutes, transportation statutes, and medical assistance statutes. On page 85, section 20, there is language relating to the sale of catalytic converters. Those who purchase catalytic converters have to record unique markings on the converter that exists due to the creation of the Catalytic Converter Theft Prevention Program. And we create the Catalytic Converter Theft Prevention Program. On page 88, sections 23 to 25, allow the Commissioner of Commerce to enforce certain statutes that regulate toxic children's toys. On page 88, we begin sections relating to default under a self-storage unit lease and how notice is given to the occupant, how personal items are removed, and how legal proceedings are performed. Then on to page 93, we have Article 7, Miscellaneous Commerce Policy. Section 1 relates to abandoned underground petroleum storage tanks and where the financial responsibility lies when the storage tanks are on property that is being held by the state in trust for a local taxing district. Section 5 on page 98 contains a repealer related to this section. And then on page 94, section 2 relates to the use of existing easements by electric cooperatives to install broadband infrastructure. It outlines how the cooperative is to give notice to the property owners and the county and the recourse the property owner has. On page 96, section 3, we have an instruction to the Minnesota Council on Economic Education on how they're to use the grants that are appropriated to it to provide education relating to economic and personal finance. They have to report to the Commissioner of Education on these efforts. And then on page 97, section 4, allows collection agency employees to work from home until May 31st, 2022. And then skipping all of the energy and environmental policy, down on page 143, there is Article 9, which includes the salary increases for commerce insurance fraud specialists and related appropriations. And that's it for the policy.
Right. Next, we will take testimony, starting with the Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Commissioner Arnold. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and thank you everyone for allowing me to make a few comments. I just want to thank the chairs, Chair Stevenson and Long in the House, and Deems and Senjum in the Senate, and the staff for all of the work on this omnibus bill. As you can tell from Solvay and Ms., and Laurie's detailed walkthrough, there's a lot in the bill. It's a really strong package of proposals that contain really powerful consumer protections. It'll create jobs and will bolster Minnesota's clean energy economy. I'm really appreciative of the inclusion of the governor's budget priorities, including funding of Commerce's operations. With these funds, we'll be able to fill department funding shortfalls so that we do not need to look at service reductions for industry or consumers. In addition, I'd like to highlight a few strong consumer protections that are contained in the omnibus bill, and we're really thankful for inclusion of those. The first is the debt buyer regulation. This is an industry that the department gets a lot of complaints about. But we don't regulate the industry. So this step of licensing will give us some ability to have conversations with these companies when we do get complaints. Toxic toys enforcement is another that I'm really, really excited to see in this package. So, you know, as a reminder, these are substances that are currently banned under law, but the department doesn't have enforcement authority as it does for other substances. And so in the event that we, you know, are made aware of these substances being in toys or if there's an unsafe crib, we can't enforce an action. And as a parent of small children, I can tell you that this one is near and dear to my heart. The Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights is gonna provide some really strong protections for student loan borrowers and a framework for ensuring lenders are licensed in Minnesota. Finally, the NAIC Data Security Model Act ensures insurance companies doing business in Minnesota have a data security plan and includes a framework for reporting security breaches if they happen. I'll say, you know, the news often has reports of breaches, and so we really want to make sure that companies with a lot of people's data are having plans and are able to work those plans. So the last thing I'd like to point out is that this bill includes provisions that are important to our industries to be able to continue to conduct their business in a seamless manner. And those are the two NAIC model laws that Ms. Pompeo went through. So the Reserve Credit Model Act helps ensure strong non-US insurers are available to provide capacity to manage US insurers' catastrophic risks. And the last is the NAIC Model Act, which is the interest rate change that Ms. Pompeo walked through. It's a simple provision, but it's really important that to allow life insurers to be able to continue to sell annuities in a prudent manner during a challenging low interest rate environment. Without the change to law, we've heard that many life insurers would likely stop selling certain products that are a critical component of Minnesotans' retirement plans. So with that, I'll again thank the chairs, thank the staff working on the bill. I think I'm happy to stand for questions or Chair Stevenson, let me know what's next.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Arnold. And thank you for your great work on helping us get this bill together. I mentioned in Ways and Means yesterday, you were a phenomenal resource throughout the negotiations, both with your knowledge of the department, but also, you know, the insurance industry and the issues that are before this committee. It was a great asset to have you in the room helping us find a deal. So I appreciate that very much. We will now move through public testimony, and then we'll open up for member questions and discussion. I'd ask each of the members of the public who testify to limit their comments to 2 minutes. I'll try and give you a notice if we get up to 2 minutes, ask Ms. Miller to just give me a little poke if we get to 2 minutes. So the first testifier is Bentley Graves from the Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Graves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Bentley Graves from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And on behalf of our members and their employees, I want to thank you for the opportunity to voice our strong support for Article 4 of the Conference Committee report related to evaluation of mandated health benefit proposals. Minnesota requires coverage of roughly 60 benefits as part of fully insured individual and group health insurance products sold in the state. And by some estimates, Minnesota ranks in the top 5 of the states with the most mandates. And obviously, each of these coverage mandates was passed by the legislature to help Minnesotans access coverage for certain healthcare procedures or treatments, and they all help. But it's also true that they all come with some costs. Research has indicated that the average mandate increases premiums between somewhere around 0.5% to 1% annually. And mandates tend to have a larger impact on the premiums of small employers who do not have the advantage of self-insuring, which provides greater flexibility around plan design and benefit offerings. 70% of our members who offer health insurance coverage to their employees purchase coverage in the fully insured market. It's these small and mid-sized employers and their employees who bear the full cost of Minnesota's extensive coverage mandates. It's difficult, however, for legislators to weigh concerns about costs against the impact that a coverage of a specific treatment or procedure could have on those who seek it. The provisions of Article 4 will ensure that as new benefit proposals are brought forward that would add to Minnesota's already long list of mandated health benefits, legislators will have access to reliable data and information about the cost-benefit trade-offs associated with each proposal. It's our hope that such removal will both inform and improve the process through which future decisions about Minnesota's mandated benefits are made. I want to thank the committee for the bipartisan support it's given to this proposal. And first and foremost, I want to thank Representative Elkins for helping to develop this proposal and carrying it in bill form. And I want to thank Chair Stevenson, Representative O'Driscoll, and the members of the conference committee for working with the Senate conference to find a way to get this done. And I want to thank the many members of the committee, like Representative Rasmussen, who have taken such a keen interest in this proposal and have offered their strong support as well. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify and offer our support. Thank you for your work on this, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. Our next public testifier is Sarah Rother, teacher in the Chaska School District. Ms. Rother?
Good morning. My name is Sarah Rother. I've been a teacher in the Eastern Carver County School District for 20 years. I've invested a lot in my own professional practice. My educational journey and the opportunities it has created are a critical part of my teaching. Unfortunately, my education came with a hefty price tag, a price I could only pay with loans. I am also the mother of two amazing daughters who are 9 and 6. They are the ones who motivated my husband, Travis, and I to get our financial affairs in order. We wanted them to grow up with a healthy relationship to money. I looked for information about loan forgiveness, but there's little out there. I eventually learned about public service loan forgiveness, though it was still very overwhelming to navigate. I applied for consolidation and an income-driven repayment plan. But then I got the first of many confusing, inaccurate communications back from Navient about my application. The first estimate that my loan servicer gave me showed an initial payment of $2,875. I was shocked, but thought that I could make that one-time payment work. Then I looked at the fine print. Initial payment did not mean a one-time only first-time payment. It was what they expected me to pay every month. But on the same page, they also showed a maximum payment of $500 a month. I felt like I was being misled. I was frustrated and angry. This is exactly what I did not want my daughters to see on my face: financial stress and worry. I want them to see education as a gateway to the future, not as shackles of insurmountable debt. The Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights protects borrowers like me by requiring loan servicers to respond in a timely manner, provide accurate information, communicate and evaluate eligibility for income-driven plans, and face consequences if they continue to take advantage of borrowers. Thank you for including language in Article 6 that will help student loan borrowers like myself have the resources we need to navigate debt solutions and ensure loan processors are behaving properly. Minnesotans need someone on our side to protect us from abuses by loan servicers. I am grateful that with the Borrower Bill of Rights, our state will have the power to examine practices by companies that don't have my interest at heart and hold those companies to a higher standard. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next testifier is Aaron Cocking from the Insurance Federation. Mr. Cocking.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Aaron Cocking with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Thank you for the invitation to testify on Section 18 this morning. I want to thank those involved in making sure that this provision was included in the Commerce deal to Chair Stevenson and Chair Dame specifically as they negotiated this, and what an important provision this is. As you might recall, this bill was heard by this committee on March 19th and passed without any objection. This bill is simple in what we are trying to do while being very complex in the underlying subject matter and application. At a very high level, this bill seeks to allow the Minnesota Workers' Compensation Insurers Association, the MWCIA, to collect and include three additional data points for inclusion in their annual rate-making report. Those three data elements are losses developed to their ultimate level, trend, and loss adjusting expenses. The MWCIA is the state's data service organization for workers' compensation. This means that they collect policy level and aggregate level loss detail to create accurate rates as well as experience ratings to policyholders. Current statute and rules prohibit the MWCIA from including the aforementioned data elements in their annual report. This leads to some unfairness between large carriers and small carriers. This bill would improve the accuracy of the rates and promote better competition amongst carriers. Losses developed to their ultimate level is the full amount that a loss would cost. Imagine that you have a worker who has a permanent total injury at 20 years old. The wage loss and medical costs that will be due to that injured worker could run into their 60s, 70s, and beyond. The MWCIA is not allowed to calculate that full cost into their report. They currently only develop those losses out to their 27th year. This obviously leaves a fair amount of cost unaccounted for in the rate. Minnesota is the only state in the country that does not allow losses to be developed to their ultimate level. The second data point to include in this bill is trend. An overly simplistic way of understanding this is looking back at past losses to see what could be expected from future losses. The final data point that was included in this bill seeks to include loss adjusting expenses. And loss adjusting expenses are the costs associated with adjusting a loss. Anything from the adjuster's time to medical records to attorney's fees are part of loss adjusting expenses and are costs that need to be figured into any claim to understand the total cost of the claim. The final piece of this bill gives rulemaking authority to the Department of Commerce, and the rules cited need to be amended to reflect the change in this statute once it becomes law. Based on my conversations, the Department of Commerce is supportive of this bill. In fact, over the whole course of this, I'm unaware of any opposition to this bill. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, for including this provision in the Commerce deal. Happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cocking. Our next testifier is Michelle Weber from the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Ms. Weber.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Michelle Weber, the Director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. I want to thank Chair Stevenson, Chair Long, Chair Dames, and Chair Senjum, as well as Representative Feist, who authored the original bill to provide expanded funding for closed captioning for legislative proceedings. The Legislative Coordinating Commission serves as a fiscal agent for many of the activities that cross the House, the Senate, and the joint offices and commissions. Over the last year, in response to COVID-19 and necessary health and safety protocols, the legislature expanded the number of channels that they were streaming legislative proceedings on. It required the Senate, under the leadership of Steve Senek, to expand from 2 channels to 4 channels, and the House, under the leadership of Barry LaGrave, to expand streaming services from 2 channels to 5 channels. One of the unfortunate things that we were not able to address through that expansion was the provision of real-time closed captioning for those expanded web streaming channels. The funding in this bill, the $310,000 in general fund dollars in the first year, will allow us to purchase technology so that real-time closed captioning can be provided. And then the additional $33,000 each year that was put into the base for the LCC will allow us to pay the maintenance and support costs. So we are very grateful for the inclusion of those funds in this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. The next testifier is Scott Reimer from Federal Electric Cooperative. Mr. Reimer.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Stevenson and the rest of the committee. You all have done a fantastic job working with us and our cooperative associations. My comments this morning are around the electric cooperative powers, which begins on page 94, line 1 through page 96, line 29. Clearly, broadband has been something that you can't hardly go a day without hearing about some broadband issues that have either come up from the state side or the federal side. It's very important that we get broadband, high-speed broadband to our rural Minnesotans. Here at Federated, we don't actually have any broadband infrastructure in the ground as of yet. I think 5 co-ops in Minnesota do. Clearly, this easement language is going to make it a lot less intrusive for us to get this infrastructure out to those members. So we thank you for that. The funding that is going to be appropriated for broadband, namely the border-to-border broadband grant, is going to be very important to us. This, along with the other funding that goes with it, and just the cooperatives that are willing to provide the infrastructure that hasn't been provided thus far by other entities. We understand the complexities of it. It's a very difficult task at hand, but as we did back in the 1930s, we brought electric service to farms and ranches in rural Minnesota, and we're more than willing to do that again with broadband services. But we have to have partners. There's a lot of good partners out there that we work with. I have two partners in my counties, Martin and Jackson counties, and we're more than willing to get this underway. And we just like to thank you for all of the work that you've done to get it this far. And we look for great things to come in the future. Thank you all.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Ron Elwood. Mr. Elwood.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Vice Chair Katiza Watun, Leader O'Driscoll, and members of the Commerce Committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today to speak in strong support of the Commerce and Energy Agreement on Consumer Protection and Energy Matters that is reflected in House File 6. Particularly, I'd like to speak on Articles 5 and 6. And specifically, excuse me, I would like to highlight and appreciate the inclusion of the Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights and the provisions updating Minnesota's storage lien law. I want to thank the Minnesota Self-Storage Association for working so closely and collegially with Legal Aid to come together on this specific language, helping both consumers and storage facilities, and that is reflected in the agreement before you. And finally, I would like to express our appreciation for the inclusion of the increased protection of the energy security for low-income Minnesotans during the cold weather, and thank the utilities, including the cooperatives and the municipal utilities, for working with the conferees and the stakeholders to reach agreement on that provision. So I also just want to recognize and appreciate the hard work of all the staff, and thank you and Chair Dames, Chairs Long and Senjum, and all the House and Senate conferees for this very sound compromise bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Our next testifier is Jeremy Estenson. Mr. Estenson.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Jeremy Estenson. I work for the Stinson Law Firm, and I'm here representing the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, more commonly known as the Scrap Metal Recyclers. In the beginning of this session, in fact, even during some of the interim sessions last year, we became aware of an increase in catalytic converter theft. And while we didn't see, our member companies did not see a lot of these catalytic converters showing up in our facilities in terms of an uptick in volume, they were nonetheless being stolen and going somewhere. So a variety of legislators introduced legislation to attempt to solve that problem and asked for our expertise and our input. Some, including the chairman, came out to visit our facilities to see and observe the problem from our perspective. And one of the biggest challenges is that these devices are not easily identifiable. They're not serialized. They are not necessarily, one catalytic converter is not for a particular type of car. You can look at a big box full of catalytic converters and even as an expert, not necessarily know which cars they would belong to, let alone which make they belong to, let alone which specific model. So for that reason, the chairman asked us to work together with a bunch of stakeholders, including the Department of Commerce and Auto Theft Task Force, chaired by Joe Bakke at the Department of Commerce, to come up with some solutions. And with some creative thinking and encouragement by the chair, we came up with a project to create some sort of a marking system that the Department of Commerce will oversee and to help not only track catalytic converters, but also hopefully to deter theft. As it stands, Mr. Chair and members, there are stakeholders who have some questions and concerns. I don't think their concerns are insurmountable. And in fact, I think their concerns may ultimately make the bill better should we be able to come up with some language in short order. But I think we're on the right path, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all of your encouragement, and I'm confident that we can come up with something really functional. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Estenson. Our next testifier is Senior Commander Kurt Hallstrom of the St. Paul Police Department. Commander Hallstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and everybody present at the meeting today. I don't need 2 minutes. I just want to, you know, throw support behind the catalytic converter portion of the bill. Just to put some numbers on it, last year in St. Paul, we had 1,166 catalytic converters reported stolen in the city of St. Paul. And this year at the end of May, we had already had 841. And we know that those are numbers that are just reported to us. And we know there are more than that. Our community is struggling. Oftentimes the victims of these crimes are not capable of fixing a $1,500 a bill for this. So, you know, the bill will definitely make our jobs easier when we run into people with cutoff catalytic converters in their vehicles. Just last week, as an example, we found an individual that had three or four of them in the trunk of his car. But currently, as the bills and the laws stand, we're not able to show where those came from. And he was released with no charges pending. So really want to thank everybody. I think that this bill will definitely help in our ability to address some of these catalytic converter thefts that are striking our communities throughout the state. And I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next testifier is John Dukic of the Department of Transportation. Mr. Dukic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Once again, John Dukic with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And I'd like to thank the chairs and committee for including the volunteer driver provisions in Article 6, Sections 12 through 19 of the bill. These provisions are intended to address an issue where some volunteer drivers have been misclassified by some insurance agents as transportation network company drivers or commercial vehicle drivers, which they are not. They simply use their personal vehicles and receive mileage reimbursements to assist people, primarily in greater Minnesota, with transportation to medical appointments and grocery shopping and other errands. The provisions in this bill essentially define what a volunteer driver is and is not, and should provide some clarity to those folks who are volunteer drivers across the state to ensure that they can continue to provide the crucial services for those who need it most. So I'd just like to, once again, thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee for including these provisions.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Tiffany Collins from the Minnesota Public Transit Association. Ms. Collins.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tiffany Collins. I'm the transit director for the Central Community Transit. We serve Kandy Ohio, Meeker, and Renville counties. And currently we have a fleet of 34 buses serving the three counties. And bus transportation is for all ages. We transport children going to and from school, daycare, and other extracurricular activities. Adults ride the bus to and from work and appointments, and the elderly use the bus for medical appointments, groceries, and visiting their spouse or friends, or just to get out of the house. In addition to public transit, CCT uses over 50 volunteer drivers. And on behalf of the CCT, and as a member of the Minnesota Public Transit Association and a member of the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access, I want to thank you for including the income tax subtraction for volunteer drivers. It is in the bill on page 11, section 7, volunteer driver reimbursement. Volunteer drivers are a lifeline for seniors in rural Minnesota. They volunteer their time and use their personal vehicle to provide transportation necessary medical appointments throughout the state of Minnesota. Many areas of rural Minnesota don't have access to transportation, such as special transportation providers, the public transit, Uber, or Lyft. Volunteer drivers who are reimbursed at the IRS business rate save local, state, and federal funds. Currently, the rate is 56 cents per mile. Recruiting and maintaining a pool of Compassionate, qualified, and motivated drivers is essential to the success of any volunteer driver program, especially for the overall rural transportation system. Again, I would just like to take this opportunity to thank you for providing the income tax subtraction to correct the flaw in the tax system, which created a disincentive to be a volunteer driver by taxing them on mileage reimbursement over 14 cents, the charitable IRS rate. Thank you.
Thank you. And I see Ms. Miller saved the best for last, because our last testifier is Don Simonson, who, in addition to being with the Volunteer Driver Coalition, is a constituent of mine. So, Ms. Simonson.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Appreciate the recognition as a constituent. So, Don Simonson, I'm the president and CEO of Trellis, and we're a nonprofit organization located in Arden Hills. And we help people age well in the community. And I, too, am here to speak and thank you for including the definition of a volunteer driver in House File 6. I'm a co-chair of the Minnesota Volunteer Driver Coalition, and we've worked with you and others to be certain that we can define for stakeholders, including vehicle insurance companies, that volunteers are not commercial drivers and should not be treated as such. Volunteers volunteer their time to transport older adults and others who cannot drive to get needed medical care and to give them access to the community. Volunteer drivers are an essential part of our transportation system, particularly in rural Minnesota. In the last year of our survey, they drove more than 9.5 million miles to help 76,000 people. We need to retain volunteers and grow their ranks as the population ages. Now, all 80 plus organizations in the Volunteer Driver Coalition are grateful to see the definition moving forward for passage this session. You know, four have worked very hard to seek a solution, namely the Minnesota Public Transit Association, the Minnesota Association of Townships, the Living at Home Network of Block Nurse Programs, and the Association of Area Agencies on Aging. State entities, including the Minnesota Board on Aging and the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access, advocated for this definition, and we thank them and their members. We also thank the authors of the original bill, Representative Mary Murphy and Senator John Jasinski. So thank you again, Chair Stevenson and committee members, for helping to ensure that volunteers can continue to help their neighbors and others who live in their communities get timely access to health care and services. You've taken a significant action to make Minnesota a good place to grow up and grow old. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Simonson. That concludes our public testimony. We'll now open up the floor for member questions and discussion. I will note the time is 9:33, and we have a floor session, I believe, at 10 a.m. So we can go for another 15 to 20 minutes, and then we'll break, because I know some members probably want to make their way to the physical floor from their offices. So Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you will be getting to this at the end of conversation today with committee. What is the path for this bill to the floor? Do we know what day is going to be calendared? Do we know if there's going to be an energy hearing on it? What's the future for the bill when it's done with this informational today?
So after it's informational today, the Energy Committee is also holding an informational hearing that I believe will take place at 10:30 or 30 minutes after today's floor session. So there's an informational hearing in House Energy today. It was, as I mentioned, heard in the House Ways and Means Committee yesterday. I anticipated getting second reading on the floor today. I don't have information about when it will be calendared. I hope that it will be soon. Representative O'Driscoll, any follow-up to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I have for now. Thank you.
Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note my gratitude for all the members of the committee and all the work that we were able to do together this year, for you and for Representative O'Driscoll carrying the commerce provisions into the Commerce and Energy working groups and putting together such an amazing package for the people of Minnesota. I particularly appreciate the inclusion of the toxic toys enforcement provision, as the commissioner noted earlier. Also being a parent of small children, this is something that was particularly important to me, and I'm proud to carry that bill, as well as the Minnesota Council on Economic Education appropriation. So thank you so much for all the hard work, and I look forward to all we're going to accomplish together in the future.
Well, thank you, Representative Katizu-Tun, and thank you very much for your service as vice chair in this committee this year. Just a phenomenal asset to the committee, and I appreciate very much our hard work on both those provisions and many others. Representative Haley.
Well, thank you, Chair Stevenson, and thank you as well for a well-run committee. I've enjoyed serving on Commerce for a number of terms. I did want to comment on one important piece, though, that I think is left out of the Commerce bill, and that is the continuation of the reinsurance program. And I did notice in the documents for today that there was a letter from a few stakeholders in support of discontinuing the program. And I think as this has been discussed over the last number of weeks, there's some misinformation out there about the reinsurance program, and we have gained new insight and information from the federal government on how the new federal subsidies called the ARPA subsidies will be implemented in Minnesota. In fact, tomorrow, the MSHA board will release numbers on what the uptake is on those new subsidies. And there's really great concern on the number of Minnesotans that will not qualify for those and the impact that discontinuing reinsurance will have on destabilizing the market. So I have grave concerns about this, and believe that this is a mistake that we're not including continuing the reinsurance program in this bill. And I hope that it's something that the legislature continues to work on and that will be included in a final budget package eventually in the next week. So thank you, Chair Stevenson, for allowing me to make those comments.
Of course. Thank you, Representative Haley. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Haley, thank you for raising that issue this morning. We know we have lived through Minnesota's private market and individual market destabilization, 25 and 30% premium increases. And in our hard work with this bill and this concept, Representative Haley, you and I both know that beginning July 1st, initial premiums will be a shocker for people. And by October 15th of this year, when those are approved, they will be a real shocker. Without the fifth year of the reinsurance program in Minnesota, and the same thing coming in 2022 in October. Federal subsidies go away at the end of 2022. Higher premiums stay forever with our policyholders and those who are in the most vulnerable markets in the state of Minnesota. So it is not a political issue. It is an issue that is good for the people of the state of Minnesota. And so thank you, Representative Haley, for raising that issue this morning.
Any further questions or discussion to the bill? Seeing none, well, I will once again thank all the members for your fantastic work on the provisions that made in this bill and the stakeholders. There are any number of provisions as we were going through the list of public testimony. I just was taken back to so many great conversations throughout this year of stakeholders working together to reach compromise agreements that everyone can live with. We saw that with the volunteer drivers and the self-storage and the catalytic converters. You know, that's the kind of work that this committee does, and that's what we said at the beginning of the year that we wanted to set out to do. I think because we were committed to doing that kind of cooperative work, we got a lot done, and I think we can be really proud of the work product we were able to put together, particularly in light of the fact that we are the only divided legislature in the country, but we have a bill here that gets a lot done that Democrats and Republicans can be supportive of, and that includes provisions authored by Democrats and Republicans. So this is a good bill. I appreciate everyone's good work on this. Look forward to discussing it further on the floor. I will just alert members of the committee that our work towards the budget is nearing or at its endpoint, but our work as a committee is not over. I anticipate, obviously, next regular session that we will have a lot of work to do on the areas under control list. I do expect some committee hearings on an informational basis during the interim, and we will be in communication with members about those as soon as we are able to schedule those. But we have a lot of work to do on a lot of important subjects, and so I look forward to working with all of you as we go forward. Until then, the committee is adjourned.